On this week's 51%, the Trump administration is promoting an unproven link between Tylenol and autism. We speak with Planned Parenthood's Dr. Stacey DeLynn about what moms should know.
There's absolutely no credible study that exists to suggest that taking acetaminophen during a pregnancy is in any way linked to autism.
We also learn about how cuts to SNAP Ed funding are impacting nutrition programs across the country. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The Trump administration recently made an announcement promoting an unproven link between the use of Tylenol in pregnant mothers and autism. The claim has put some doctors up in arms who say there is no definitive proof that acetaminophen, the technical name for the drug, in fact causes autism. Many experts agree that autism can be caused by a lot of different things, genetics being a leading factor. As WAMC's Aaron Shellow Levine reports, advocates in New York's Capital Region are questioning the administration's rhetoric.
The Trump administration asserted, with limited evidence, that the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy causes autism. Trump specifically named Tylenol, a brand name for the over-the-counter drug.
Acetaminophen, is that okay? Which is basically commonly known as Tylenol, during pregnancy can be associated with a very increased risk of autism. So taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good.
President Donald Trump said the Food and Drug Administration would begin notifying physicians immediately to recommend limited use of the drug while pregnant. New York Assemblyman Angelo Santa Barbara represents the 111th District, which encompasses portions of the Mohawk Valley, Amsterdam, and Schenectady.
I think that it's important for families to have access to information that's rooted in trusted science. The announcement, a lot was said. It reminds us of how complex autism is. I have a son with autism. He is 23. And we've been on a journey together. We share a lot of experiences that families do, having a child with a disability. But it also shows us how urgently families have a need for clarity.
The Democrat, who chairs the Assembly's Committee on People with Disabilities, says the rhetoric used in the announcement can be dangerous and distract from important work being done to help individuals with autism and their families.
Look, I agree with the Autism Society. I read their statement very thoroughly, and they warn against making premature claims. It's very risky, and I agree with them. Again, doing so can re-traumatize families, stigmatize families, stigmatize mothers, shift focus away from what we just talked about, what many in the community see as urgent priorities. And it's these programs and services, the supports, the ARCs, Liberty ARC does such a wonderful job in Amsterdam. These are the organizations that are out there. They're doing the work that's helping individuals with autism thrive, reach their full potential, find employment, do things that they want to do in life.
Dr. Noor Syed, an associate professor of applied behavior analysis at SUNY Empire, says the claims made by the Trump administration aren't based in rigorous scientific research and could regress how we approach autism and neurodivergence. Syed is the Turbin Director of Autism Advocacy at SUNY Empire's Center for Autism Advocacy, Research, Education, and Support, or CARES.
This reminds me a lot of the idea that was proposed 70 years ago that refrigerator mothers are the cause of autism, which was completely inaccurate and has been wholly debunked, and also that the MMR vaccines are directly linked to autism, which those data were falsified and that finding was retracted. So when we focus on these areas that don't have the research to support it, we are taking time and resources away from what really matters.
CARES is focused on building inclusive environments for autistic and neurodivergent individuals instead of asking them to change to fit societal norms. Syed says President Trump's rhetoric is dangerous.
Autism, neurodiversity, it's not an epidemic. Focusing on cures, I think, is something that's highly problematic. Really, every autistic individual, every neurodiverse individual is unique and special and incredible. And what we really need to focus on are ways that we can empower the community with knowledge, accurate knowledge, and ways that we can, again, have the environment be as supportive and as effective as possible. And so to frame autism in such a manner can be more harmful and dangerous and helpful.
I'm Aaron Shalu-Levine for WAMC News.
In response to the federal government's announcement, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists reaffirmed its own recommendations regarding acetaminophen. So what should expectant mothers know? Dr. Stacy DeLynn, Associate Medical Director of Planned Parenthood Hudson-Peconic, says it's important to discuss any medications you may take with your doctor. But she still recommends taking Tylenol appropriately when needed and will continue to prescribe it to her patients.
There's absolutely no credible study that exists to suggest that taking acetaminophen during a pregnancy is in any way linked to autism. So there's been more than two decades of research on the use of acetaminophen in pregnancy. There hasn't been a single reputable study that successfully concluded that the use of acetaminophen in any trimester of pregnancy causes any kind of neurodevelopmental disorders in children.
Where is the federal government's claim that Tylenol can cause autism even coming from? Is that something that you can speak to?
You know, I think that there was a study that was an early study with some limitations that was presented that I think that might be being pivoted off of. But there, you know, even recently, we've had really two high quality studies on this subject, one of which was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association last year. And so, you know, ACOG and organizations, you know, large medical organizations look at all of the available data. And the study, which was a really high quality one in JAMA last year, once again found no significant associations between the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy and children's risk of any kind of neurodevelopmental disorders, like including autism, ADHD, intellectual disability. So, you know, we look at these studies really well to see if there's like a lack of control for confounding factors, or if there's like use of unreliable self-reported data, which I think some of the folks online are referring to. But, you know, we look at the overall broad evidence collected over time, and we know that it's very safe.
Okay. What are the recommendations for taking painkillers during pregnancy? I mean, what are your options if you're pregnant?
Yeah, we do know that there are other types of pain relievers that can cause issues during pregnancy. So acetaminophen is one of the few options that's actually available to pregnant patients to treat pain and fever. And fever can be really harmful to pregnant people and fetuses when left untreated. So, you know, things like fever, headaches, pain are all managed with the therapeutic use of acetaminophen. So it's really important to be able to continue to offer that. You know, I'm a doctor who provides prenatal care. So my patient's health, their baby's health are always my top priority. So given that it's the only option most pregnant people have for pain management or for fever reduction, I'm going to continue recommending it as a treatment plan.
You mentioned that fevers themselves can be dangerous. I guess, what are the risks associated with fevers?
Absolutely. The risks of fevers are things like miscarriage early in pregnancy. Fevers are associated with a lot of different kind of septic conditions. So we want to avoid fevers as much as possible when they happen. So acetaminophen is a really important tool to be able to do that.
Okay. In general, if you're going to be taking acetaminophen or Tylenol, like, are there recommendations in terms of like how much and how often you should take it if you're pregnant?
Yeah, you should always do it in consultation with your OBGYN. And, you know, we offer that advice to patients. Sometimes it's dose dependent, or sometimes, you know, it's trimester dependent. But, you know, for it's over the counter, it's widely available. Typically, the recommendations on the bottle are pretty safe and well tolerated for anyone. It's not typically used as a long term medication, but for these acute conditions, it's really important for pregnant people to be able to use them.
you know, you mentioned that like this is one of the only safe painkillers that pregnant women can take. What are the risks of other painkillers out there?
Sure. So, you know, we do know for things like ibuprofen that acetaminophen is recommended over it because it can cause risk of miscarriage in early pregnancy, and it can cause risk to the fetus's kidneys when used later in pregnancy. So, you know, we really recommend acetaminophen as a safe alternative.
And are there other, I guess, common medications that women who are pregnant should be aware of?
Yeah, so, you know, we have really, really well studied which medications are safe in pregnancy and which aren't. This is something really detailed that when a person becomes pregnant, their OBGYN will speak with them about in detail about which are safe, which are well tolerated, which should be avoided in pregnancy. And so, you know, it's obviously extremely frustrating from our perspective to have, you know, politicians speaking about what we know to be safe, because ultimately these conversations should be left to patients and their providers.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, when the federal government makes announcements like this, how does that impact your work?
You know, we're having to have more conversations with our patients, which is something we're obviously always happy to do. I think what's unfortunate is that folks who aren't chatting with their doctors and, you know, finding out how safe this medication is might be avoiding medication that they've been previously told that could help them. And as we mentioned, you know, having a fever uncontrolled, having pain uncontrolled, causing a lot of stress from pain. These are things that, like, we really worry about. So once again, we really just ask patients to check in with their doctors about what we know to be safe in pregnancy.
Dr. Stacey DeLynn is the Associate Medical Director of Planned Parenthood Hudson-Peconic. Dr. DeLynn, thanks for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Take good care.
When President Trump signed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act over the summer, it wiped out funding for SNAP-Ed, a federal grant program providing nutrition education to low-income individuals and families eligible for food stamps under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. SNAP-Ed programs teach people how to make the most of their benefits, how to shop for and cook healthy meals, and how to live a healthy, active lifestyle. In addition to classes, these programs also promote better access to healthy food and help identify communities where food insecurity is high. But all of this, as of this taping, is set to close at the end of September. Shayna Russo and Bintu Hines are the leaders of New York's SNAP-Ed program in the Hudson Valley, with the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Orange County. I recently spoke with them to learn more about what the closure means for workers and participants.
Nationally, as of September 30th, we will receive no more monies for SNAP-Ed. It's distributed differently, different allocations for each state. In New York State, what we're able to do is take any funds that we haven't spent in this current fiscal year that we're in, which ends September 30th, and utilize that to help us wind down programming. So there will still be programming happening in New York State, but it would be at limited capacity in different regions based on staffing. You know, again, it would slow down and wind down, but we're grateful for at least being able to wind down with respect to our communities and respect to our partners instead of abruptly ending on September 30th. So, but there are states who are, they just don't have any rollover funds or carry-in funds. And so they will be ending as of September 30th. So some of the websites that they do will, you know, go dark in this case, but we're fortunate to be able to carry over for a little while.
These programs essentially help people make the most of their benefits and make healthy choices. You know, aside from affording food in the first place, what kinds of nutritional obstacles can SNAP recipients face?
Yeah, Bintu, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So some of the challenges our population sees access, right? Access to healthy food for their family. So that might look like not having access to a supermarket to purchase their fruits and vegetables. People also have challenges with preparing the food. For example, if we think about our homeless population that's sheltered in motels, they do not have access to a kitchen or, you know, the tools to prepare the food There's also the challenge of time. Many of our recipients are working adults, working multiple jobs, so having the time to do this cooking and nourishing of their family can be a little difficult. And then there's also this challenge of knowledge, right? If you didn't grow up learning how to prepare our favorite vegetable on our team, which is butternut squash, you know, even if you receive it, even if you have access to it at a supermarket or at a food pantry, you will not know quite exactly what to do with it. And funds, of course, the big one, having the funds to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables on the regular and have their family try new things. That's also a challenge that exists.
Out of curiosity, why is butternut squash a favorite vegetable?
So butternut squash is one of those, if you've ever, you know, we talk about like the concept of like give somebody a fish, right? Teach somebody to fish. So if you gave somebody butternut squash, but you didn't actually investigate one more level, and then you say, oh, teach them, like, this is how you cut it, this is how you do it. SnapEd takes it a step further and goes like, well, do you have a sharp enough knife? Cause it's hard as a rock. Are you able to roast it or peel it? Because if you don't have those opportunities, you can't eat raw butternut squash the way it is. And so though it's a great step that they get that food, it's really important that we talk about how to utilize it with the tools and resources that they have, and even think about maybe they don't have those tools and resources. So can we partner with, like, we just did a partnership that Bintu can talk about with Orange Ulster BOCES, with Gleaned Produce, and they did minimal processing. They helped cut up tomatoes to make a fresh salsa, right? So if they can help peel and chop the butternut squash, those students are learning from SnapEd and their teachers about knife skills and doing that. And then the community is receiving a more simple version, which means that it would more than likely be consumed. So that's, you know, for us, food isn't nutritious until it's consumed. And so we want to make sure that no matter what food folks are getting, they are able to consume it and it's able to last as long as possible. You know, can you freeze it? How can you store it? How can you make the money that you have and the food that you have last as long as possible, especially when time, health and other priorities, housing costs, bills, really start to weigh on particularly the population, but in general, I would say many people these days.
You know, when it comes to people who might be in shelters or hotel rooms, who might not even have a kitchen available, what advice do you usually give them? I guess I'm just, you know, curious, how do you even cook in those environments?
So the great thing with our programming is that we really think about the population that we work with. We meet them where they're at. So some of the things our educators do is assess, you know, when we start working with a population to find out exactly what they have at their disposal. So, you know, in the case of the motels, usually it's a fridge, maybe a microwave. And so we make sure that our education takes that in account. So it might be like providing no cook recipe or not a lot of tools or equipment recipes that they can use within the space that they have. And so if you go to our website, you'll see that we have recipes on there, a ton of them, and they indicate what tools you need in order to prepare it. And so we're very conscious of that. You know, microwave recipes are another one that we do. Just keeping it simple, and the big thing, you know, saving time also, because people don't have a lot of time.
Bintu, you also work with what the program calls its community change efforts. Tell me more about that, and what does that mean?
We do policy, system, and environmental change. So, you know, we talked a bit about the nutrition education, but nutrition education just goes as far as the environment you live in. So I can teach you how to eat fresh fruits and vegetables, but if you do not have a supermarket or a farmer's market in your neighborhood, how far can you go with that? And so that part will be lost as well, where we work with schools, food service directors to encourage serving, preparing, exposing children to fresh fruits and vegetables. And, you know, those schools are really places where sometimes this is the only place that the kids get a meal for the day. And so that part also gets lost in the work that we do, working with partners, medical partners, to bring awareness to food insecurity. And to, you know, work with local organizations and supermarket to increase access, creating systems to process clean product. That is also a big system change that we're working on. And so SnapEd disappearing also would in some way affect those efforts that are long-term and create systematic, sustainable change.
So will we see those efforts go away completely, or will they just go to other organizations, perhaps?
Yeah, it'll vary. So it's a great question. So the good part about New York State having us having funds to kind of roll into this next fiscal year past October 1st is that we can help figure that out, and we can think about sustainability plans and doing that. And hoping that somebody has capacity to take on those pieces. You know, our ultimate goal is to create sustainable change. So some of the projects are fairly new. And so creating that sustainability, I should say, will be a little bit more rushed. But our intention is to do what we can. And our partners, again, are phenomenal. But there will definitely be a decrease in resources, a decrease in knowledge and information. A lot of times we're a facilitator, a connector of folks in the different sectors. So from the medical sector to the grocer, they're not typically talking, but now we can be that connection and say, oh, you know what, like there's a medical center here. They're identifying a lot of food insecurity. We have the opportunity to do these vouchers through another partner that gave us funding for that. And now we can do education and they can come shop with the local vendor. So, you know, we are oftentimes that assistance and that facilitator. And so those pieces are something I don't know that could be necessarily replicated for future change.
How many people in New York, at least, use SNAP-Ed?
So the state numbers across the state, just in the education component, it's 217,000 across New York State that are being reached through the program. And then that's again, just in the, they're in a group education class, they participated in that way. But then, as I mentioned, that more, the bigger piece that the Nutrition Ed often leads to with our partners is that community change. And that's like, that's over 750,000. So that's things like updating a wellness policy, connecting gleaned produce to the culinary program, to a local social services agency, so that the food is making its way to the folks. And that creates a sustainable pathway. So, you know, how many people over time are going to be influenced by that? Bintu works on a fruit and vegetable prescription program. So we have our medical partners that are screening for food insecurity and then referring to nutrition education. And then with that, they're getting vouchers to be able to go to local markets and utilize them there. So everything's kind of circulating. It's back and creating these systems. So, you know, again, 200,000 just in nutrition education classes and sessions, and then over 750 across the state based on the systems change, the policy work, environmental work that folks are doing.
Okay. And for the workers in these programs, does the loss of funding mean they will lose their jobs?
Yeah. So it's a fantastic question. So across New York State, there's over 200, I'll say, full-time equivalents that SNAP-Ed funds go towards. It depends on the offices and it's different within each region. If there's availability of a position within an agency, then yeah, they may just be able to transition to something else. But if there is nothing else and they're 100% funded by this project, then yeah, positions would be lost. And we have seen staffing shift since the signing of the bill, just unsure of what was going to be able to happen and how each state would be able to handle if there would be carry-in and things along those lines. So
is this loss in funding kind of forcing organizations like Cornell Cooperative Extension to, I guess, you know, re-examine their long-term programs and what they will pursue in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes. simply stated, yes. You know, we're, again, Cooperative Extension is 10 of the lead associations across the state for this program. So us, along with the other 7 community-based agencies, most of them located in the boroughs, we're just trying to figure out what can be done, what options are out there. Is there an option for state funding? Is there an option for local foundation funding? Is there an option for other grants? So yeah, really trying to, again, the funds that we have, make them last as long as possible, spread the information about what is happening, because it's a confusing dynamic to tell folks we're ending, but we're continuing to wind down and still be out in the world. So yeah, we're definitely seeing what's possible and what can really be built on the shoulders of SNAP-Ed. SNAP-Ed has been around for over 30 years. And so really, like, how can we continue to elevate community nutrition and not let it phase out? We have a huge infrastructure. We have phenomenal educators. We have tons of resources for the community, and we're embedded in the community. You know, we live and breathe in the Hudson Valley, particularly here, and the same case with all of our other regions.
Well, in the last days of this program, is there anything else that you want participants to know?
Yeah, fantastic. So as Bintu noted, we're going to keep the website up as long as possible. So we do see, again, in that state role that I play, we do see the website staying up at least for the next 4 to 5 months. And we hope a little bit longer than that. So we're kind of, again, we're managing our money to see how long the program can go. So all of our digital tools should stay up. So that's the snapedny.org website. They can find things on Facebook and Instagram as well as YouTube. So all of that SNAPED New York components will stay up. And again, within each region, here in the Hudson Valley, we do plan to have at least 4 months of programming. Again, once we get to that part, we should see if we can go another 3 or 4 as well. But it'll all be at limited capacity. So reaching out is probably the best step right now to see what folks are able to do and continuing to communicate with local cooperative extension offices or local community partners. That we're doing it, but we are looking for sustainable partners as well, like who can help to carry on some of the things that we won't be able to do as staff shift and change. And they may be local departments of health, they may be other community partners and agencies that we do partner with. You know, we have over 1,500 partners across the state for our work, so none of this is done in a silo. I think that's really important to note, but we want to make sure that we continue to be a spoke in the wheel to keep things moving. We don't want a bumpy ride for anybody.
Shayna Russo is the program manager, and Bintu Hines is the regional team leader for the Hudson Valley SNAP Ed program with the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Orange County. As they mentioned, their SNAP Ed website will remain up for a while as they wind their programs down. You can learn more about their work at cceorangecounty.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King from 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night, head on the hall.